Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Buddhist Center podcast with me, Chandradasa. Our first episode in a wee while, and I'm delighted to be back with you, and particularly delighted today to be welcoming some artists to kind of re-begin the podcast or to kick off this new season. I'm not quite sure what to call a podcast season these days. People say things like pods instead of podcasts, which I find a bit ghastly personally. I guess this is a new season of episodes, and it feels fitting to be starting with art as our theme. I'll introduce you to our friends, our Instagram influencers, our stars soon. But first of all, if you enjoy this podcast, if you've enjoyed listening to it in the past, please tell somebody. The world is awash in podcasts. I heard somebody talking about it being inevitable these days that you have to have a podcast if you're doing anything. So the world has got many, many podcasts, and the best way to judge whether something's worth listening to is if your friends tell you so. So that's really the best thing you can do. If you like this episode, if you're inspired by what our guests have to say, tell a friend, tell one person, pass it on. But I'm very happy to be welcoming three lovely friends, lovely artists, all of whom have appeared on the podcast before, I realized, when I was preparing for this. And we'll link to their individual episodes in the show notes. It's always great to talk to each of you on your own, but I'm very happy that you're all together. I don't know if this has happened before, where we've had such an august collection of artists and Buddhists working together. In some ways, I'm guessing we'll at least revisit some familiar ground today, looking at what it means to be an artist and a Buddhist, because our context is that we are all members of the Triana Buddhist Order and community. That's what this podcast is about, is surfacing, well, what does it mean to be a Buddhist in 2025, or whenever you happen to be listening to this? I don't know, 50 years time. Say you're listening to this in the future. Hello in the future. This is what it was like to try and figure out what it was to be a Buddhist ages ago for you and in the present day for us. So let's say hello first, and then we'll talk about a wonderful show you're collaborating on in London. So maybe a good way to introduce yourselves would be to say hello from wherever you are, tell us where you are. And it'd be great to hear about your names. We've all got these amazing Buddhist names. Most people have no idea what they mean, but they're so, they're like hidden jewels that every so often we bring out and we hold up into the moonlight or the sunlight. So let's hear this full evocation of who you are. And I'll welcome you first, Abhayavajra.
Thank you. Yeah, my name is Abhayavajra, my Buddhist name, and I've had that for quite a long time now, getting on 30 years, I think. So it's become very much my name. And the name means, Abhaya refers to the quality of fearlessness, and Vajra indicates the nature of reality, let's say, in this case. So my name is encouraging me and challenging me to be fearless in the face of reality. And that's what the challenge I'm presented day by day by my name. So it is, that's me, Abhayavajra.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And lovely to see some of your work in the background, I think, on screen. Unfortunately, yeah. Our users can't see it, but I can see it. And the same goes for you, Mitajyoti. Lovely to see your studio and that beautiful moon and staff, I suppose, on the wall behind you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. My birth name is Claire Botton-Harvey. My Buddhist name is Amitajyoti, and Amitajyoti means boundless or immeasurable light. When I was given it, my preceptor said that it was linked to me as an artist in the sense that it's about light, appreciating light. You could say it's like the light of awareness, really. And one thing I love about it is that awareness can go everywhere. I just love that awareness can go everywhere. It's linked to Amitabha as well, the Buddha of the West, in terms of the mandala, five Buddha mandala, the Buddha of love or compassion, so a kind of loving awareness. So it's an inspiring name. It's something to live up to, to try and live up to.
And welcome to you too, Paramabodhi, our most recent guest, I think, mainly because we've been doing some work together in recent times. We've been on retreat together. It's been lovely. I came to visit you for lunch, I think, last time I was in London. Welcome to the podcast. Let's hear about Paramabodhi.
Paramabodhi. It's my 40th anniversary this year of being given that name. It'll also be my 70th year of being Hugh Mendes. So it's a nice match. Anyway, so Paramabodhi, I was given that name by Sangharakshita in Italy in 1985. And he told me this name, Paramabodhi, which meant nothing to me. And then he said, well, the meaning is supreme enlightenment. And I said, you've got to be kidding. So he then backtracked slightly and said, well, no half measures for you, all or nothing, which fits my personality to some extent. He also interestingly said he felt the name rolled off the tongue nicely, Paramabodhi. And he said, that's quite helpful because I know you're going to be doing a lot of teaching. And it has borne out to be true that I have done a lot of teaching. It's been a very big part of my Buddhist practice and art practice. I've taught pretty much consistently in both fields ever since. So Paramabodhi, there you go.
Perfect, supreme one. Urgyen Sangharakshita, for those of you who don't know, was the founder of this particular community. People used to be ordained a long time ago in Tuscany, if I think was right, yeah. Now often in Spain these days. I'm often slightly wistful that I never got to go to Tuscany because I've been there on holiday and it was so beautiful. I guess it's interesting listening to your names just as a kind of way into conversation. Reality shot through all of your names, as you'd expect from Buddhists and as you'd expect from people following in the footsteps of revolutionary Buddhists like Sangharakshita, who, like many teachers coming into the West in the 60s and 70s, doing translations of the Buddhist tradition, trying to figure out how that could be carried into our context. Sangharakshita had a particular connection to an affinity with art as almost an alternative Western spiritual tradition outside of the religious spiritual traditions in the West. So it seems good that we have three artists here, all of whose names are replete with the mysterious, whatever it is that we call reality. I guess in terms of the way that manifests in the world, you're all coming together for a new show at the Art Pavilion in Mile End Eco Park in London in the UK. I was very curious about why you decided to join forces in this way. Like, how did that come about?
Yeah, so, well, originally Abhivajra and I teamed up and we found this amazing venue. And we just thought, as time progressed, we thought, oh, it could be interesting to have a third person involved as well. And so we were thinking about who that could be. And we both landed on Paramabodhi. We just thought, oh, even though all of our work is so different, you couldn't sort of imagine three artists' work so more different than ours in a way. But there is something linking as all. Yeah, so hopefully this podcast will reveal some of that.
I was going to say, just to follow up what Amity Jyoti said, I think that our three works might look very, very different. And it could raise the question for anyone seeing it together, well, what is the connection between the three works? But that is something to be discovered and explored. And I think the interesting question is, what is the connection? You know, how does our work fit together? And again, I think in a way, Paramabodhi's work seemed to create that third positive tension or something, if you like, in the ensemble.
I was slightly surprised, but when I thought about it, I thought it did make sense somehow. The third dimension, whatever, a different angle. The thing that interested me was to exhibit with other Buddhists. Because although I exhibit my work a lot in all kinds of different contexts, I hadn't exhibited in an overtly Buddhist context like this with other professional full-time Buddhist artists that don't make pictures of Buddhas, if you know what I mean. So that was interesting to me. And I know the other two people quite well, and I'm aware of their work. So although initially I was surprised, actually I was very glad to be asked. And very interested. Also, the setting, the Eco Park Art Pavilion Gallery, it's a beautiful, quite massive space surrounded by trees and a large pond. And I go there almost every night at the moment. It's just behind where I live. It's full of swallows and swifts every evening at dusk. It's incredible. And there are also herons and lots of swans, baby swans, ducks. It's a fantastic setting. It's just gorgeous. There are lilies floating on the pond. So that also appealed to me. I've never exhibited in that space, but I've been very aware of that space and been to lots of other shows in that space. So lots of things that interested me. And we still, as people are suggesting, it'd be interesting to see how the show evolves in that space.
I was just going to say you will have attracted lots of people along to see the venue and the bird life and things, apart from coming to see the art. So that's very good promotional bit of talk.
One of the most beautiful gallery settings in London. It really is. I mean, it's very big and very light. And you look out onto this beautiful, it's almost a lake. It's a very large pond. Anyway, it's beautiful. Just come to see the beautiful pond.
And what are the dates of the exhibition, Mr. Jyoti?
The dates, it opens on October the 2nd, so that's a Thursday evening, and we'll probably open around 6 o'clock, I think, and then the show is open from the 3rd till the 12th, inclusive, daily. I'm imagining something like 11 till 5.
Wonderful. That sounds so beautiful. It made me think of, I was in Japan a couple of years ago and went to some exhibitions, and they were all in beautiful places like that. It's almost like the natural place where you'd put an art gallery is a place where you can also see a green heron or a kingfisher or something like that. Very beautiful.
We have grey herons here. There's quite a lot of them. Kingfishers as well, but I haven't seen them, but other people have. There's a pair of kingfishers.
So I guess one of the things that might come up for anyone just listening even to that exchange is a slightly tongue-in-cheek question for all of you about, are you an artist? Are you a Buddhist? Are you an artist Buddhist, a Buddhist artist? Does it matter? And I suppose the serious thing behind that is whether there has ever been a tension in your practice, either as an artist or as a Buddhist. Those two, if not identities, but even the fact that you're kind of juggling two names often in your public and private life or different aspects of your life. And how have any tensions or questions resolved in your own minds, assuming they have resolved, of course?
It's an ongoing process. There's always tension in any practice, I'm sure, whether it's art practice, Buddhist practice. Personally, reflecting on it, partly because of this show upcoming, I feel like it's been a very long, slow process of integration between my Buddhist practice and my art practice. It's sort of obvious in a way, but it's taken me a good 20 years to kind of come to some degree of understanding and realization of the two aspects of my practice, if you like. As a commonality in what I'd refer to as mindfulness, it requires a lot of mindfulness to make the paintings that I make, sustained mindfulness over long periods of time. Buddhist practice, I think the absolute epitome and keystone of it is mindfulness. So there's a very simple way of looking at it through mindfulness. And how that manifests for me is totally different to how it manifests for Amita Jyoti or Abhaya Vajra, which also very much interests me. Everyone's practice is very different, and let alone their art practice. Or I'm sure the others could add to that from their own personal experience.
Yeah, I think for me, there was a real tension initially. I remember Ratnagosha saying to me, he said, well, maybe you could think of yourself initially as a Buddhist artist. And over the years, that emphasis, it doesn't seem necessary now. It's like I'm both. It does feel like there's a simplicity now. But what I did at the time when I was very much feeling the tension, I was seeing that I needed to really ground myself in my Buddhist practice. That's what I think I needed just as a human being to really do that. And at the same time, I was learning about painting. And I was studying both Indo-Tibetan Buddhist iconography as well as looking at modern art and contemporary art and the history of art. So I think the two things were sort of going along together, alongside each other in parallel. There came a time when I was making Buddhist art, I was making images of Buddhist figures. And there just came a point where I just didn't want to do that anymore. It just felt limiting. I think I'll probably go back to it at some point. But at the moment, I just realized I wanted to spread my wings and kind of really have more of a relationship with what's going on in the contemporary arts. Because, I mean, it's just very obvious that there are so many values which are akin to Buddhism that are taking place in the contemporary arts. So I just felt like I wanted to have a dialogue with that. And I feel very much a Buddhist, but that feels more like implicit. I don't feel a need to sort of talk about it.
I can't promise I won't make you talk about it at all, Amitabh Jyoti, but we'll see what we can do on this podcast. Abhaya Vajra, what about you? How have you held over the years this, I suppose, creative dynamic tension between different parts of one's identity and being that are nonetheless trying to approach the same thing? Again, this sense of reality being shot through your experience and now your name.
I think this has been quite a large question about my adult life in a certain way. I wasn't aware quite that it was for many years. I trained as an artist, exhibited, etc., did all the accepted normal things, trying to be successful as far as I could. I was only semi-successful for at least 20 years. I don't know. I think very much trying to find a way that for me always seemed a little limited within painting. Amity Jyoti just mentioned, for instance, Tibetan art, and I remember being very interested in art from the Far East and from the Middle East, art that had some, I suppose, other religious, spiritual tradition behind it. I think for many years I was stuck with feeling almost envious about having that dimension as a possibility, but feeling as a Westerner, for some reason, I felt that it would be disingenuous and probably inauthentic for me to start, for instance, painting that was influenced, say, by Tibetan art in particular, and also Japanese Zen art. I just felt limited by the culture in which I was brought up. And I'd certainly rejected Christianity, which had been part of my earlier sort of childhood. And I can see now that it was me who was bringing the limitations to my view on things. But I know that's how I felt at the time. And I was never fully satisfied with my work, even though I can look back now and see some of the possibilities that existed in it that I never felt were fully available to me at the time. All that culminated with a complete break for me. This must be the end of 1990. I got very seriously ill. That stopped me working anyway. And that coincided with my first contact, mainly with Sangha Rachita, the main teacher and the founder of Tri Ratna Buddhist organization. In fact, that sort of created a 10-year gap where I gave up serious painting, actually, for a long time. I got involved at the London Buddhist Center. I managed a Buddhist business for 7 or 8 of those years. And then something, process that I can't really sort of verbalize now, sort of drove me to wanting to go back to explore. Was there a way in which painting could be relevant to my Buddhist practice? I was practicing without painting, really. So in a way, it was a very unintegrated thing. And since 2000, and I had the opportunity to move to Vajrasana Retreat Center in the Suffolk countryside, which is where I am now, I was looking after the retreat center, but also had the space and the time to investigate what going back to painting would mean for me now. And some of that was a fairly painful, in some ways, integrating process of not knowing quite what I was doing and where I was going. But I stuck with it for some reason. And it's only about the last 10 years since 2010, really, that I felt I'd really had a resolution of that conflict. And now, I don't know, I just feel that the work I'm doing and my practice really are the same thing in some ways. Obviously, in lots of ways, like Paramabodhi said, mindfulness. But also there's a degree of discovery in the work for me. I don't know what's going to happen when I paint. And at best, what it shows me is something which, for me, seems to chime and resonate with the Dharma as I understand it. So it's been a real process for me, but one of which the last few years, I think, has come together in some sort of integration. I can only talk about it in very vague terms at the minute, and it is a process that's continually ongoing. Yeah.
That wasn't vague at all about it. That was great. Lots of very interesting evocations of what it's like to live a lifelong practice. You know, it changes. It's never the same through different periods, and it's great in a way to hear that sort of questioning underneath it just manifesting in different ways. Paramabodhi?
Follow up something that Abhayavajra was saying there, relating to mindfulness. Apart from the fact that it's a very slow process, it would seem, this process of integration or resolution or evolving one's spiritual practice, art practice, or those aspects coming together. It seems in all cases, it's not something that happens quickly. But I was going to say something about mindfulness, which I mentioned, and I mean mindfulness in the sense of mindfulness of reality, which touches on what Abhayavajra is talking about. not just a matter of being concentrated, but being concentrated on reality, on especially death and impermanence, which is the characteristic of reality, if you like. My stuff's very overtly referencing that. But as a practice, it's not easy to bear it in mind. It's not easy to maintain any degree of mindfulness anyway in our modern world. But to have that overt mindfulness of reality, mindfulness as insight practice, which is what Buddhists are concerned with, basically, sustaining that is not that easy. But it seems, funnily enough, my art practice has actually lent itself to that very easily, partly through just circumstantial, in-my-face awareness of death repeatedly through my life. It's always been there, especially personally, but non-personally as well. Even if I didn't want it, it would smack me in the face. It's often the way for people. Anyway, maybe that was just a little follow-up from something I picked up from Abhaya Bhadra.
It also chimes with my own practice. I think that's something that really does unify all three of us, is this sort of emphasis on mindfulness and the dimensions of mindfulness. It's not a black and white. It sort of really can open you out into whole realms of multidimensional experience even.
Well, it's very interesting to listen to all of you, because I suppose I'm imagining now, I'm in the imaginative space of thinking about October, and I'm mentally planning how I get from the US to London in order to actually see this show. And it'll be really fascinating to hear the reviews of it. You know, people in an urban environment in London, but going into this beautiful space of nature that's somehow been carved out, that Parama Bodhi, you evoked so well. The gallery is very beautiful. We'll put some pictures of it in the show notes so people listening can at least get a sense of the context where these paintings will be on display. And there's a particular atmosphere in art galleries too. And it'll be interesting to see what the reviews are like around that presence, I suppose, is one of the things you seem to all be evoking a little bit, is each of you bringing something with you. And it'd be quite good to go into each of your work actually a little bit, in case people aren't familiar with it, or even if they are, to revisit. Amita Jyoti, I was thinking about you because we have been working together over the past couple of years on these amazing online retreats that you've been doing with Fish for Pani, looking at least principally at imagination and creativity as sort of essential elements for anyone interested in Buddhist ideas, Buddhist practice, mindfulness, meditation. A favorite aspect for me with those retreats has been you evoking your, in some ways, quite practical as well as symbolic sense of meaningful relationship with the natural world. And in that context, you just really encouraging people to play. We've had sessions where people who absolutely do not see themselves as artists are nonetheless encouraged, allowed in a way that allowed, they're given the sort of permission to play with just what it is to be conscious and alive, which can sometimes take quite a bit of courage, particularly when it has to take physical form, like a piece of work. A lot of people are intimidated by that, just that idea, I'm not that sort of person, I can't do that kind of thing. It's very beautiful to watch you just very gently unlock that for people, or that space that people can choose to go into if they like. As a little advert, we'll be doing some of that again on the Buddha Center Live next April, so do watch this space. But you write very movingly about your own work involving this strong process of imaginative attention, the kind of thing we're talking about here, mindfulness, engagement, connection, communication with what you call more than human, even relationship to your materials as being alive. I was very struck by something you wrote that I read this morning about the linen, it being a two-way relationship with the linen that you're making marks on, and how all of that somehow relates to being in reality. So I wonder if you could speak a bit about how your own work's been informed by this explanation of the nature of mind and life itself.
Yeah, thanks, Chandradasa. So, as I mentioned earlier, my work started off, I was looking at Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, and I was looking at the ancient European traditions as well, the Celtic tradition, and exploring symbolism and myth. And for many years, the work was studio-based. So I was in the studio for probably more than 20 years and worked in that way, exploring the nature of mind through these symbols. And it's been a fascinating process because there's some amazing symbolism out there in the world. So seeing the patterns of the mind. It was during lockdown, actually, that I was walking quite a lot in nature. I was walking a lot in the forest, which is quite close to where I live. And I just started to have a different experience of the forest. I mean, maybe, you know, so many of us became more sensitive, more alive at that time. I became curious about what was going on there. I became curious about, well, the forest seemed to be woven and communicating so much consciousness. And I just was fascinated by it. And I thought, I want to make work out here. I want to sort of experience this and see what the nature of this is. So my mind in relationship with all this. So that's what I've been doing over the last about 3 years or something, working out in nature.
Mm. And can you say something? I was really fascinated by this evocation of you finding the more than human in nature. And I think the first thing I thought was, I wonder why Amitajyoti talks about it being more than human rather than other than human.
Yeah, I think the main thing, Chandradasa, when we other something, we create a separation with it. But when something is more than human, what I'm pointing to is multiplicity. I mean, we have so many ideas at the moment about the problems that we encounter through being anthropocentric, through being so identified with our perspective as human beings. So the work, it's aiming to experience things from a more multidimensional perspective, where other things, where the more than human can be equally valued.
Mm, that makes sense, because I wondered about othering, and I thought, is she doing a hierarchy? Is it more than human because somehow there's a necessary redress in our attitude to the natural world, where we take the huge multiplicity of life, the whole biosphere, and we accord it its place again in a way that we simply haven't? Is it to do with all that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See, when I read that as well, I thought some people might think more than human might be referring to AI and technology. So I'm very glad that it's so overtly the opposite of that. I think that's very interesting, personally. I didn't really want to mention AI, but we're absolutely riddled with it now, whether we like it or not. And some people might refer to it in those sort of terms, like more than human. However, I love the fact that you're more than human is the natural world that we are just part of. And it also, in a way, brings to mind perspective. I've always felt we've got a very, very limited perspective. I mean, it's not bad, but it's very limited. I'm constantly aware of my own drastic limitations. And sometimes I get a glimpse of a bigger perspective through mindfulness practice, if you like, through art, through all sorts of things. But, you know, art at its best will expand our awareness, our consciousness, our perspective shifts, if you like.
Hmm, that's very interesting. It never even occurred to me to think of more than human as AI, but now it makes perfect sense. Just as a small defense of AI, it's going to make this podcast sound a lot better. I can tell you that much. It's very good to hear how much all of your work explicitly and implicitly deals with impermanence, interconnectedness, two central foundational, as it were, considerations of any Buddhist perspective on reality. And I'm interested in that word perspective. Obviously, it's a key term in painting. Abhayavajra, last time we spoke, just over 5 years ago, I think, was about the idea of you painting into reality. That's what we called the episode of the podcast. And I remember you talking about your love of paint itself and how you see yourself more like an archaeologist, revealing something urgent and crucial about the human condition by adding rather than scraping away layers, was what you said. How appreciating beauty itself is like a healing force at times of stress, and art being a properly adequate response to suffering in this reality we're all taking part in. In your recent work, you've talked about exploring meaning through playing at the boundaries of colour and form. I guess it's probably an impossible question. I like to ask impossible questions in these podcasts, but can you say or hint at something of the mysterious resonance you find at the boundary of colour and form?
Yes, well, that sounded very good, didn't it? What you said, I said.
You were very lucid.
Yes, I think what, in a way, I was going to say explore, and I think what I am trying to do as best I can is explore, and explore in the sense of going into a territory, if you like, not knowing quite what's there until you're there, really. That's, in other words, I don't actually know how my work, the painting that I'm setting off on. I don't know ever how it's going to come out. Perhaps that's always the case, but that feels to me to be quite important to me, actually. And this probably does connect with what I said 5 years ago, but it feels like it's me uncovering something. It's almost as if when it works for me, the painting, my response is, where did that come from? Or something. And then I use that position as a stepping off point for the next painting. What I'd have to say is that over the last 5 years, the way I work and the materials I'm using has had to change. And that's just simply, I've had to let go of my expectations of what, with age, what my body can do. I can no longer get to my large studio, which I have just had to let go. I'm having to work on a smaller scale, and I'm having to use, in a way, different media from the large, perhaps quite thick oil paint that I was using before. But there is a connection with it, and it is about having a sense of going into the depth of the painting, or if you like, the depth of the painting being uncovered and coming out to the surface. Before, I was using oil paint quite thickly, wet on wet. So whatever colour was laid down in the painting, and we are talking abstract paintings here, was continually conditioning everything else that was put on top. And you could look into the painting through different layers into the original colours that were put on first. I'm still doing that, and I'm having to do it in a different way. But the same process is going on. And now the painting is both what I'm trying to do is explore an experience in depth, looking into the painting and the depths of the painting coming out towards you, and breadth as well, because I'm having to work smaller. I'm sort of working with a tension between the painting that's there physically is complete unto itself. It makes sense compositionally and emotionally within itself. And yet there is still the suggestion, and more than a suggestion, that it is part of a larger whole. So the painting gives you an experience, hopefully. That's the experience I have when I'm doing it, of depth, going into depth, and that the different colours are relating together to create something which is a colour experience, which is an accumulation, and in its relationship between all the individual colours, and breadth as well, that the painting could seem to be saying something about a larger perspective than just the physical presence that you've got on the wall. Very difficult to talk about, but it's like something clicks sometimes in the painting, perhaps a bit more often than sometimes. And I know that all those elements have come together, and what comes out is something that seems a little bit more than the parts that have gone into it. You'd have to see it, of course. Talking about painting is, what's he on about, they might think. Well, you'll have to come and find out, really.
Well, they can see some of it online. It made me think a little bit about intention when you were talking there. Intention as an artist in colour. I mean, there's so many things we could go into there. Be fascinating to have a conversation about aging and art and how it changes when it comes to intention. For some reason, it brought to mind when you were talking about the relationship between looking through the colors, the way they were laid on in an abstract art context, like de Kooning's late work, where he's got dementia and he's going into his studio every day and he's still layering on these colors. Yeah. And there's a big ongoing conversation about what's the value of a painting and if the person who's doing it is suffering from Alzheimer's. But actually, when you were talking there, I thought about those paintings. I thought, well, there is the habit that, from a Buddhist perspective, this is samskara, the idea of our conditioning habits that make us who we are, and colour being part of that, like how we handle, how we just put down colour without thinking, does have intention in it, whatever state the mind or the brain is in, as it were. It's a really fascinating area, how intention can express through something like colour rather than thought or articulation.
Yeah, I mean, the language of abstraction is our whole experience, the whole experience of subtle sensations, subtle perceptions, in the way that Bhavadra's talking about it. I mean, his paintings are just absolutely beautiful, and you just need to stand in front of them and your mind changes in the way that his does, presumably, when he's working as well. Yeah, it's a language. It's an amazing language, which is purely sense-based. We can only begin to touch on it through words, really.
Yes, I think I probably always have tended to this, but it's become more almost a discipline for me, is the paintings that I'm doing now are built up out of very few colours. So my intention is the colours that I choose when I start the painting. And what happens during the painting is a whole, quite subtle, but range of different ways in which those, it could be only four or five or six sometimes at the most colours that I choose to begin with. I don't know how they're going to interrelate particularly. That's why I'm interested in finding out that they can interrelate in almost an infinite number of ways and create the colour experience, which is generated by them integrating together. So five or six colours will create another colour depending on how they're relating. It's basic colour theory. But I'm using them in a fairly disciplined way now because no matter how disciplined I am with them, the variations just insist on coming through. And that's what gives a sort of life to the colour life to the paintings I'm using.
I was just going to say something about colour there because it's quite interesting about Avadhra. Well, you mentioned colour theory. And of course, I only ever use three colours because they're primary colours. It means actually I can use any colour because all the colours come from those three primaries. So, but it's still interesting. But the other really interesting thing is, of course, talking about painting. Chandradasa, you mentioned that we can see them online, but of course we can't, can we? It's completely impossible. You have to come to the show and see the paintings. It's one of the things I teach painting in an art school, have done for 20 odd years. And I constantly tell the students, luckily we're in London, they can go and look at paintings. You want to learn about painting? Look at paintings. Don't look at them online. Don't look at them in a book. But it's very interesting talking about painting. That's a bit different. It possibly is better than looking at a reproduction or an image on a screen. But I was also having this fond memory of taking Paramananda. Some of you are aware and familiar with Paramananda, and very old friend. We were ordained on the same night together. We've been friends ever since. And he's now pretty much blind. But I took him to a Picasso exhibition in London not that long ago, and we would stand in front of the paintings and I would describe them to him. So although we were standing in front of these paintings, he has some visual awareness. I would talk about a green, perhaps, and in his peripheral vision, he could have a sense of greenness. Anyway, it's interesting because it just brought back that memory of taking a blind person to a painting show. I mean, actually, these days, there are lots of facilities for differently abled people to interact with art, including for blind people, not just in a tactile way, although that is also included. Anyway, it's just interesting. All I'm saying, the short of it is go and look at paintings, whether it's this particular show or another show, if you're interested in painting.
You're quite successful these days, Paramabodhi, so I'm sure you could fly everybody in to London who wants to go and see this show.
I'm only successful in a non-financial way. I just met this guy who used to buy lots of art. He doesn't buy any art now because he said nobody's buying any art because nobody's got any money. That's our issue. But I used to have sell-out shows and that was all pre-lockdown. The last, whatever it's been, 5 years or so, it's a very different world. So although I have a lot of exhibitions, I've got three exhibitions on currently. I've sold a total of zero.
Oh, well, it was worth a try. But your general injunction as well, heard. If you can't get to London to see this show, go and find some paintings where you live. There will be some paintings where you live somewhere, yeah, and engage with them. I just want to bring Amitajyoti Ewan, because Paramabodhi mentioned his friend, our friend Paramananda. Paramananda sometimes leads particular retreat on, I guess, meditation and Buddhist practice as alchemy, or as a sort of analogue to alchemy. Very, very interesting. We'll put in the show notes the series of talks he did about this, which are really, really worth listening to and engaging with, and also an online retreat you can do asynchronously around this. it brought to mind your color palette, Amitajyoti. I know that you explicitly referenced the alchemical tradition in your choice of colors, white, black, and gold. Yeah. I wondered if any of that's kind of resonating with what Abhayavajra and Paramabodhi have been saying.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I do use these, like Paramabodhi and Abhayavajra, I do use a limited palette. And I think that is another thing that draws us all together. So I'm working with three basic colours. So these are some basic colours from the alchemical tradition, white, black, and gold. And I'm using them, it's for a few reasons, actually, but I'm using them primarily because I want to point to the work as a transformative process. In terms of the alchemy of the work, the transformation, I mean, in a way, all of our work is transformative. I think I should say, in order to sort of unpack the alchemy, I should say a little bit about what I do in nature. So I go out into the land. I've been working for a couple of years at Alfoxden Buddhist Retreat Centre, which is amazing. I started in Epping Forest and I loved it there, but there were things I wanted to do in the forest that I couldn't do because it was a public space. And I just thought, I thought it'd be great to have a space where I could just be a bit more contained and work on a piece of work over several days. So I asked Alfoxden Buddhist Retreat Centre. So I've been working there for a couple of years. So I go out onto the land and set up the space. The paintings are very big. They're like 2 meters square. So it takes me a while to go out and set up the space. So it takes me a couple of hours. So I'm walking out there with my trolley and my materials, go out onto the land, set the space up, and really practicing at that time, really practicing with awareness, just looking around at the space, looking at the light, feeling my feet on the ground, on the earth. So really tuning in to sensory perception. So that's like the four foundation of mindfulness, sort of body senses, feelings, thoughts, and the environment. So there's a kind of calming, settling thing that goes on with just setting up the materials. And then after a while, once I've finished setting up, I'll pause and I will begin to communicate with the land. So I'll invite a dialogue with the land. So I'll ask the land various questions, invite a dialogue, and then just see what arises. So this is very similar to Abhayavajra. I don't know. I don't have a preconceived idea of what the painting will be. So it's that kind of openness and receptivity to the process that allows me to be affected by it as well. So I'm kind of showing up and I'm acting and I'm responding and I'm relating, but I'm also like really receptive to what happens. So that's where the alchemy begins.
Thank you. Very beautiful to hear that evoked, you being part of the environment, you being part of the ecosystem rather than just documenting it or witnessing it even. You're there. I suppose environments are quite an interesting aspect of this. It's fascinating to hear you, Amitajyoti, talk about putting yourself in a particular space in nature in order to kind of co-create the work. That's an appropriate way to talk about it, with your environment. Paramabodhi, we collaborated fairly recently on an online space. Sorry that it's online only and not in person, but it's still very beautiful around looking at this amazing series that you've been working on for years now. It's kind of become quite central to your practice as an artist and a Buddhist. The series is called Obituaries, which hopefully we can hear something more about. The thing that I'm reminded of by listening to Amitajyoti is watching you work in your space, completely different kind of environment, I hate to say it, but almost the archetypal artist studio. Like, I loved it. And actually, the feedback we've had to that place has often been about people rejoicing and getting to watch you work at your palette, just the beautiful disorder of your space. The trains going past in the background was a big feature.
It's very ordered.
Is it? Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it when it's really, really, really ordered. We loved it anyway. Our team had a great time knocking around your space with you and just, but when I say disorder, I don't mean untidy. I mean, it's a bit like walking inside somebody's mind, like seeing how they order on their own terms, like the ideas and the influences. And You were giving us a guided tour and pointing to the radio, the Roberts radio on your windowsill, I remember, and picture of Dr. Ambedkar and all sorts of different things, a bit like just what comes to mind. It was a bit like walking around inside your mind as an artist, just seeing all these associations. And I remember you were particularly alive that day, wanting to give us a tour of the objects that mattered to you. A photograph of your dad, an old lover, all these things that were lying around, books that meant something to you now or in the past. We'll link to that space and the wonderful things in it in the show notes. I was really struck getting to know your work and you a bit on retreat, how much the physical act of painting, a bit like with the Bhayavadra, sits in relation to meditation and absorption. And you make connections when you talk about this to the 17th century Dutch still life painting tradition. Can you say something about how your awareness of those connections has deepened over the years of going further and further into this obituaries work, this connection to impermanence, the connection to being a Buddhist, a teacher, a practitioner, and somebody who knows how to attend to what's happening and at least how to try and come into relationship with that through your work?
Yes to all of that. Yes, it's complicated, isn't it? In a way, it's very, very simple and direct. It is about impermanence. It functions within the tradition of still life, painting objects, painting inanimate objects, in this case, bits of newspaper, flat objects, which, like you said, references 17th century Dutch still life. It did start with my dad's death when I was living in America, teaching at the San Francisco Buddhist Center. And the long and the short of it was realizing that I was next on the slab when I spent a day with him in the morgue with his corpse, talking to him. And I realized through that process that I was next, you know, inevitably next generation might take my turn on the slab. So I felt I had these images inside me that I wanted to get out before I took my turn on the slab. And the long and the short of that was that I thought I have to go back to art school, back to an academic environment in order to do that, in order to have a full-time practice. Because I felt quite strongly, if it wasn't a full-time, fully engaged practice, it wouldn't really get anywhere. I couldn't dabble in it. It's a bit like my name Paramabodhi, as I mentioned, and Sangharaksha giving me that name. If you're doing this thing, you've got to do it completely. So it was the same with art practice as Buddhist practice. I couldn't just dabble in it or partially do it or stop halfway. Anyway, so I went back to a master's. I couldn't do it in America, so I came to London to do it. Still life epitomized my experience of grief and bereavement. I was actually cutting an apple with a knife on a solitary retreat at the retreat center in America called Arya Loka, where I'm imminently going to co-lead a retreat with Paramananda, which you referenced at the beginning there, Chandradasa, last time we were out there doing that same thing. Anyway, without digressing too much, I was cutting an apple with a knife, and I thought that image held and epitomized my experience of grief and bereavement and death. You know, the apple symbolizing life, and the knife cutting it, severing. When I graduated on my MA, I graduated on 9/11. On that actual day, September the 11th, 2001. And of course, I put that apple with a knife painting that I did in my show because, you know, the big apple is New York. And the hijackers used knives to hijack the airplanes. So the knife stuck in the apple also somehow symbolized what happened on 9/11 with the bombs, the planes going into the Twin Towers and so on. I can't get too involved with that, but it kicked it off there with, I was already painting newspaper clippings as parts of still life, which goes right through the last 100 years of painting in a Western tradition. It's kind of long-winded, but anyway, so I was painting these newspaper clippings. I painted a lot of political resulting from 9/11, the war on terror. Being a Buddhist, and anyway, I was always very keen on, you know, human rights, a pacifist, anti-war. I did a lot of anti-war. I am going to show, I hope, in this upcoming show, some of my anti-war. I'm going to have different sections of work, which is kind of what happens anyway. Anti-war, they all relate to death. We're surrounded by it. You know, look at what's going on right now in the world. So I'm touching upon that. The paintings that I made around that time, 24 years ago, I could have made them yesterday. They're exactly the same, nothing different. You know, nothing has changed. It's got worse, possibly. I don't know. Within that context, the obituaries came in a couple of years later. They sort of took over. Like, these things happen, like the other two refer to this. When you're painting, you don't really know. The painting takes over in a way, or it has its own voice and its own life, and you don't quite know where it's going. And I know within each painting, I pretty much know, because I've made up the image to start with. I've got the piece of newspaper in front of me, the object I'm painting. The painting's going to look like that when I've finished. And I usually start in the top left and finish in the bottom right a few weeks later. A friend of mine described his practice as being like a very, very slow color printer. And he starts at the top left and finishes on the bottom right. In his case, 6 months later. It's a guy called Dan Hayes, a very good painter. Anyway, if they don't end up looking like that, I have to destroy them. Like, they just go in the bin, chop, chop. But they usually do. Anyway, I'm slightly digressing here, but the obituaries took over because they were very popular and some very good art critics and writers wrote about them and people wanted to buy them. And depends who they are. Right now, I'm looking at Sly Stone. Some of you might remember him. Died recently. Also, Brian Wilson died recently. So I'm painting him. He's next up in the green room, you might say. You know, a nice pair. They died the same week. Interestingly enough, I've just painted Pope Francis. So I'm a Buddhist who paints popes. I don't paint too many Buddhists, but I've painted quite a lot of popes. And this pope was quite a good pope, apparently. I didn't know much about the guy, but I liked the idea of painting popes because the popes are very strong in the Western canon, 500 years. They controlled art for a long time, the popes. They totally controlled Velázquez, for instance, just to give one example. Anyway, I quite like painting popes. I've painted all the popes since I've been doing this. There's been a few of them. You mentioned Dr. Ambedkar. I painted him recently and gifted it to the London Buddhist Center where it now hangs. That's another story. But anyway, I'm painting these things, these people, these still lives. I enter into the lives of people of significance by painting their obituary notices, the images of them, their portraits. A lot of portraits of other artists that I respect. I can look behind me. I can see Richard Serra. I can see Frank Stella. I can see Vanessa Bell even. I can see Kathy Kolowitz. I can see Wayne Thiebaud. I can see Donald Judd, Francesca Woodman, all these people. I love these people and I love painting them. That's another thing that the other people touched on, the love of paint and the love of painting. And it's so engaging and it's so fortunate to have this space where I can indulge this love of painting and get away with it. And, you know, I've had to teach it in order to facilitate it. That's where most of my money comes from having a part-time teaching job in an art school. But I love doing that anyway. I love teaching it. I love teaching the Dharma, Buddhism. I love teaching people to meditate and talking about the things that are important to me, whether they're art things or Buddhist things or both. I talk to both in both contexts, which is kind of interesting.
There's a couple of things you mentioned there. I mean, it's hard to let the reference to painting popes go by without just remembering Francis Bacon and his quite different paintings of popes from you. And that difference actually, I think, is quite meaningful because one of the things that I really appreciated about your work when I got to know it was on the surface, you're painting obituaries, but of course, behind an obituary is a life and behind a life is a story. And just even you going through there and naming the people on the wall behind you, I was particularly struck by Francesca Woodman, whose work I discovered recently for the first time, really, and got into, and very tragic story, also relating to New York City. But there's something about storytelling and just the sort of non-judgmental way in which your paintings present a story for someone to engage with or not engage with in a particular way. You could research them or you can just take them in, just stand in front of them and look at them.
It's interesting. You mentioned storytelling. I like telling stories and I tell a lot of stories. When I'm teaching, I'm full of it, stories, my whole life, a bunch of stories. But the other interesting thing, of course, is a single image can tell a whole story and a whole story of a whole life. And that's how I try to do it. I'll try and find the image that epitomizes that person, their life, what they stood for. In an artist's case, I'll remake their own self-portrait quite often. That Francesca Woodman is a self-portrait. The Kathy Kolowitz is a self-portrait. The Wayne Thiebaud is a self-portrait. That's a whole different kettle of fish there. actually remaking somebody else's self-portrait, it's a fascinating thing to get into. And, you know, I have to do quite a lot of research anyway, or I'll stand in front of their paintings if I can, or their self-portraits or whatever. So I talked about Rembrandt. Remember on that retreat when we were together at Area Loca? And I'm going to be talking about Rembrandt some more. Rembrandt epitomizes a lot about the Western canon, the history of art in Europe and paint and painting, and his self-portraits dominate his practice for me anyway. That's another story. But it's to see what I mean. It's another story.
It's always more stories. Somewhere in there is your story, Paramabodhi. Something is there, the composition.
I have been really struck by Paramabodhi's work. I mean, looking at impermanence, looking at the impermanence of life is a huge challenge for us. And one thing that strikes me is, in order to engage with the process, it's like you're loving those materials that you're working with. And what I notice about the paintings is that there is a real beauty to them. There's a real beauty and simplicity. And for me, when I look at them, that just makes it easier to have that contemplation, because there are these little nuggets, this human being looking out at me or whatever. It's a beautiful object, and just look in, and it allows me just to take that in, to take in some of that reality to the degree to which I can take it in.
It's interesting to hear this evoked, particularly in a series like Obituaries. And actually, when you were talking there at the start, Paramabodhi, there was quite a strong sense of the violence of impermanence, the war, the shocking aspect of being next up on the slab, etc. I recently had an experience of sitting with someone who was dying in their last hour, which was very beautiful and peaceful. It always feels like a privilege, that sort of thing. It's definitely still with me very strongly as an experience. And I'm guessing in a way that's part of all of our story, right? When we're practicing as Buddhists, in your case, when you're working as artists, there is a root experience that is quite intimate and soft and can be held quite close around impermanence. Quite often when impermanence gets evoked, it is the big bit of it, but the stories are often quiet and very, very personal. There's a question for me around form of a thing. You were touching on it there, Amita Jyoti, a bit. If it's not too crude a way to talk about it, is what's the relationship between the form of a thing and the process of trying, that's not too crude a way to talk about it, to imbue it with life and energy and darkness and love and light and fear and all of those things that are, again, held generally quite secretly almost, or intimately and personally, and not always loud.
Yes, I think relevant to this, what's coming to mind is boundaries. It seems like Paramabodhi's work is focused on that boundary between life and, well, you know, whatever it is that's beyond life. And I won't say just death, but there's more to it than that. Paintings in particular have got limitations. They've got boundaries. The painting sits on the wall. There's the painting, and there's what's not the painting surrounding it. There's a boundary there. I think, as I was saying earlier, from my own work, in a sense, there's a question of boundaries in depth looking into the painting. And it's as if painting calls into question the absolutism of a boundary. Boundaries can become more porous, if you like, more translucent. They break down a little bit, I think. And there is the boundary between this physical thing that you've got, not always, but quite often on a wall, and the meaning that it projects from its physical self that's communicated to someone who's standing and looking. And it might be that that does tie up with intimacy in a way, intimacy of feelings, etc., which is when the structures of our thinking and our ideas tend to have harder, more definite, clearer definitions to them. That's why we think and develop ideas. But there's something that goes a little bit more, I don't know what it is. It isn't just emotions. It isn't just instinct or intuition. We can stand in front of a painting and experience, no matter what the painting is of, it can feel like an intimate relationship that one's having, both with whatever meaning it is coming off the painting, and you're part of the process of creating that meaning. It's not separate to you. And somewhere, the artist who has spent a lot of very intimate time on that physical surface, trying to inject some meaning, feeling, or whatever it is into it. So for me, there's something about relationship between breaking down or going through or going beyond the boundaries that we create between ourselves and others, between things. Again, I can't pin that down, but in terms of art and painting, I see that very much that boundary that is softened, made porous between the artist, the work, and the viewer. The boundary is broken down by intimacy, or the breaking down of those boundaries and separation creates the intimacy.
It's a wonderful evocation. It just made me think of all the moments of standing in an art gallery somewhere and really responding to a painting. I remember standing in an exhibition of Rembrandt's self-portraits and one particular piece just almost being pulled into it. And it is a bit like standing in front of a mirror, isn't it? You're not standing in front of a mirror, but it feels like standing in front of a mirror that gives a deeper look at yourself. And maybe, I don't know if that's part of your experience painting, standing in front of your canvases or your cloth or whatever it is, your paper you're painting on, is that you're in front of a mirror and you're looking at something.
Yeah, I was just really inspired by what Abhayavajra was saying there about the mind and how the mind can soften and open and, yeah, a sense of intimacy where the boundaries soften and we can have a completely different experience of the same thing, but the mind has changed, our relationship to whatever we're experiencing changes. Oh, I've just experienced this so many times through making work. And this is also what we're doing with meditation as well. You know, we're practicing the basics of meditation, just becoming more present, more alive, more sense-based, more aware. And as you begin to meditate more, you can have that same process of the subject-object dichotomy starting to attenuate, things open up. And for me in the painting, it's like I enter into participation with the land, with whatever is arising in the land, entering into participation with it. In terms of the actual painting itself, it's sometimes as if all the materials, the paint surface itself, it's all breathing. It's all breathing this life back into things. Yeah, I'm just fascinated by what you were saying there, Abhayavajra, about this state of mind that can happen just through ordinary life as well. I mean, we all had this experience. You kind of look at a sunset and the mind softens and opens and you just get a more expanded sense of ourself, more expanded sense of the world, bigger perspective. So this is the kind of thing that I think when I'm working in the studio, when I'm working outside, and what I hear in the others, that's the kind of thing that can start to take place, which is magical. I think I'd like to make the link with Parambodhi's work very much about impermanence. And what I'm noticing for myself is going out into the land and just connecting with the environment and what arises. Well, some of the major themes that are arising are impermanence. And also I'm out in this beautiful landscape and other themes that are arising too. So not only the sort of toughness of impermanence, the toughness to bearing it, but also it can be liberative. Being in alignment with it can be freeing. But also I've been experiencing images of other places and other times as I'm working. So it's like getting images coming through. And I don't know where they're coming from, but it's like a sort of deeper sense of connectivity, an intuitive connectivity. The images are similar to experiences that people are having in Gaza. And sometimes that can be very direct, you know, as if it's an actual communication taking place. And just what does one do? The way the paintings happen, the actual way that the work comes out onto the linen is that it's an energetic expression of these experiences of either impermanence or other. And sometimes it's absolutely beautiful as well. So sometimes the land is just speaking of joy and radiance and the kind of wonder. I've had some experiences with dragonfly and various insects and a water spring. It seems wondrous just what is going on in our interrelationship with the world. It's like the world is just, to me, seems very mysterious. And it's that I'm just noticing, I'm just fascinated to explore.
Beautiful. Paramabuddhi made me think of a question for you specifically. You know, that was a lovely evocation for us, like to stand in nature and come into a relationship with something quite profound, I suppose, without it busking itself as profound. How do you choose your subjects? How is it you intuitively know that this is a subject that you want to come into a relationship with and trust that when you do regard them at the end of it, that it was the right call and that there is a sense of relationship there?
I've been practicing for quite a long time. So through practice, I learn those answers that you're asking the questions of. I learn through practice, through repeat. You know, it's like meditation, repeat, 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 repeat. It's very like that in my art practice. It's very repetitive. But of course, every painting is totally new and unique. And every subject, I mean, if I just mention the obituaries, they do dominate my practice. These are all people that I admire, for starters, for some reason or other. And I want to celebrate their life and their contribution to our lives, their significance to me personally. But then also, I'm working within this tradition, if you like. I'm very much on the end of a tradition. And the fact that I'm teaching within that tradition as well was part of it. And then I have to find an image that represents that particular person that I admire, you know, that somehow encapsulates that, like you said, that tells the whole story in an image. David Lynch is another recent one. So I rewatched all the David Lynch films, which was a great joy to do that anyway, and at least two series of Twin Peaks. So they're seminal things, you know, they're so influential. He was a bit of a Buddhist in his own way, but he's a very interesting character. He's very funny. He started out as an artist, went to art school. There's a lot of stories there, but I had to find the image, you know, the image that held all of that. And I found this image of him, moderately old, but not really old, smoking a cigarette with the little whiff of smoke coming up next to his head. And I loved painting it, of course. It was a great image. He's got this fantastic hair. So that was great to paint. And then the smoke, lovely to paint. Very difficult to paint smoke, but it was good fun doing it. And then you spend 2 or 3 weeks with David Lynch, probably a month with David Lynch, you know, watching his films and interviews with him. And he's funny as hell. I mean, what a guy. Anyway, so it's, what a great thing to spend all that time just being with David Lynch. When they're on the easel, I'll have conversations, you know, I'm sort of, hi, morning, David. You know, he's on the easel there. How's it going? La, la, la. You know, watched Eraserhead last night, you mad guy. Etc., etc. So that it's a lovely thing, you know, to engage with these people, people that I admire, that have been big influences in my life. They're big influences on the cultural life of us and the best of humanity, if you like. Lucky me. I keep thinking that. Lucky me. I get to hang out with these people, these great artists. I've got Walter Sicker over there, Gwen John, Turner, Rodin scowling at me. I've got another Pope up there as well with his big hat on. His grumpy Pope in that one. I've done two Popes of Francis. One happy Pope waving with his little white outfit on, and then grumpy Pope with his red, more elaborate gear. It's so much fun. I don't know if that answers your question, really.
Now I want to launch a range of action figures of your Pope paintings where we can have Francis in his white outfit and Francis in his red outfit. It's interesting as we come to the end of this conversation, because I'm left... You know, I'm very lucky to get to take part in gatherings like this. And I'm really struck just listening at the different modes of intimacy that you all evoke about your work, the different spaces, physical, the different relationships to impermanence. It's something I've really appreciated about the conversation, is each of your willingness to go into quite different, almost like textures of the private life of a moment where you are with your sense of life to date, your sense of reality, and coming into relationship with yourself through work, whether it's outside in the woods or it's in your studio by Vajran, dealing with all the change going on around that, or Paramabuddhi surrounded by all the weight of famous faces around you. If it's not too vulnerable a question, then, since you've all been so game so far, if you think about your sort of heart or your mind, your heart mind, as we sometimes talk about in Buddhism, and you think about your direction of travel with your work, where are you going next? Once this exhibition's gone and it's also subject to impermanence, where is it you're going next? I'm sure there's continuity too, but yeah, where is your sense of practice, whether it's art practice or Buddhist practice or any human practice, where is it taking you?
Well, yeah, I've been working on a specific piece of land for a couple of years, and I'd like to continue working there, you know, just go deeper basically with that piece of land. But also, you know, I've been working with performative dimensions to the work, working with film, photography, as well as the paintings and drawings. So I can imagine that unfolding, and I'd be really interested to explore that. And also to widen the scope of land that I'm working on. So even quite close to the place that I'm working, there is Hinkley Point, which is a nuclear power station. And yeah, I'm just curious. I'm just curious to see what would arise in different places, in different spaces. Yeah, the choice of those places. I'm just interested to see what would come from that.
That sounds really wonderful. I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with Hinkley Point. I had a great experience once a long time ago. I'd met Derek Jarman, and he'd said, oh, you should come down and visit sometime. And then he died not too long afterwards, so I missed my chance to go and visit him at home. So a friend and I did a little pilgrimage down to Dungeness to see his garden and his house. And of course, it's right beside the great nuclear power station. And Abhay Vajra, what's your canvases are shrinking, your studio space is shrinking, but your mind clearly isn't shrinking. You're still evoking this very beautiful, again, very intimate relationship to colour and the texture of paint and the layers between you and reality that help you go deeper into reality. It seems like there's a medium. You have a medium, to use that language.
To be quite honest, what I feel like saying is that I do not want to know where it's going. What I'm doing now, for instance, I couldn't have quite imagined how that looks. There is constants in the work all the way through, and I think there is in painting anyway. It's that relationship between the physicality, even if it's a relatively flat plane, the physicality and the other dimensions, the dimensions of meaning and emotion and whatever it's communicating to someone else, that's always there. Even what I'm just looking at a painting, I'm just deciding whether it's finished now, across the other side of the room. So only 6 months ago, I couldn't have imagined that painting, and it's actually giving me some clues about the next step, but I don't know what the next step is going to end up as. So although my intentions when I start a painting, obviously I intend to do this in this way, using these colours, etc. As I said, I think right at the beginning, if it works, it never works out as how I intended it. My intentions are very much less interesting than the finished result when it works. Not always. I'm very aware at the minute, impermanence very directly in terms of death, etc. I'm having increasing limitations on what I can do, which probably just result from just the aging process. I'm now 75. 76 later on this year. So far, I've managed to adapt. The paintings I was doing even 2 or 3 years ago that I had in my last exhibition, I can't do now. I don't know whether the paintings are as good or as interesting to anyone else or not, but I've managed to adapt what I'm doing to my changing circumstances. The best I can hope is that that continues as long as possible, really, because I'm a living expression of impermanence, as we all are. But at the minute, it's a bit of an unavoidable awareness for me day to day. I did go through a phase of thinking when I was having a crisis about my painting, it was really also a crisis of painting. It was very fashionable back in the 80s and 90s to say painting was dead. And I was involved and I knew lots of artists, including Derek Jarman, actually, who left painting behind. I found I can never quite do that. And so as well as adapting to my own circumstances as they change, for as long as I can, I sort of trust that painting has got enough possibilities in it to continue expressing something relevant and not just be a repetition of what's been done before, either by other artists or by myself. I've sort of got a bit of a faith that almost it's forced, but that new images will arise. And if I imagine now what they are, then that would be a bit sad, really, because, you know, they'll bring life. Life will be brought to them by conditions and circumstances as they change.
That makes perfect sense. I like the idea of trusting the future of your images rather than trying to set out in a particular direction. And Paramabodhi, in your practice, in your work, have you got a bit of a sense of your emotional direction of travel, as it were?
I like that word intimacy, as I was trying to say, intimacy with impermanence. I'll tell you, doing this podcast just now, it's been very helpful for, I'm sure, for all three of us, because we're in dialogue, you know, we're trying to rustle up this dialogue and put the show together. And it's been very helpful listening to the other two and yourself, Chandradasa, and talking and kicking it around a bit. That is the next thing on my agenda, actually, is that show. And it's after I get back from the States. So that's my next exhibition. I mean, it's funny because the whole time I've been sitting here, I'm looking at Sly Stone on the easel and I'm thinking, well, I've got to change that bit there and I've got to change that and then bring that thing out here. And I'm looking at him and he's very alive. Anyway, that's that. But that's very immediate. That's like tomorrow or the next day. And I've got this show coming up, which I'm really looking forward to. Meanwhile, I'm going to the States. I've got this very vague ongoing project with the Met Museum in New York with the chief archivist there, a guy called Jim Mosky. Another one of these long-winded stories, but I am meeting Jim for the second time. He unearthed an archive of newspaper clippings within the Met archive from a previous archivist called Arturo de Herveley, who lived 100-odd years ago and collected newspaper clippings only about dead artists. And one of my collectors in New York put us in touch with each other. It's the most fantastic thing. He's now written a book called Deaths of Artists. And I've been making some paintings. Anyway, it's an ongoing vague project. I don't know what's going to happen with it or where it's going. It's a nice project. It's nice trotting it out to people. I'm working with the Met Archive at the moment on this project relating to dead artists. I mean, they're funny. They're sensationalist newspaper clippings about artists died in their gas-filled room, artists killed self in restaurant, artists murdered by their model. One artist died on the Titanic, was last seen, you know, going down whilst playing cards on the Titanic, etc. I mean, it's hundreds of these things, hundreds of them. And they didn't even know it was there in the Met until fairly recently. This guy, Jim, found it. Two massive scrapbooks. Last time I went there, you know, last time I was on the East Coast in New York, I went there. I had a whole day with the guy and he got these scrapbooks out. He's showing me, like, going through the pages. The newspapers were disintegrating in front of my eye, you know, like fluttering little bits. I just, stop doing that, Jim. Just put it down. Like, leave it alone. I said, it's okay. It's all been photographed, but very impermanent. Blimey. Anyway, it's come to the light of day and I'm doing something with it. I'm making these paintings. I've found some of the artists were well known at the time and they have got work by those artists in the Met collection, in the archive, because none of those people are well known enough now to have them up on the main floor. So I had this whole day when the museum was closed, where I was going around with Jim, look, the whole place and the archive. That was a good day out, that one. I don't know if it'll come to anything, but something's come of it because I've made some paintings and he's made a book. So
if all it ends up being is a great story, that's enough. I mean, even people getting to hear about that archive, that secret trove of forgotten dead painters. Well, fortunately, all three of you are alive and well at the moment. As of the point of recording, dear listener, I can assure you these three people are alive and well, and they will be exhibiting together in October. The exhibition's called Painting Now, Three Contemporary Approaches. As you heard at the start, it'll be at the Art Pavilion in Mile End Eco Park in London. We'll have all the details in the show notes. If you can get there, please do get there. You never know, you might run into one of these lovely beings. Particularly if you go at the opening, you might run into a heron or a beautiful summer bird, or I guess autumn bird at that point in the year. I'd just like to thank all three of you actually for showing up today for this. I mean, I could record for hours with you three. You can just see it starting to come out now, like the practice is real, the love of it is real, the life of it is real. So thanks very much to you, Abhayavadra.
Yes, well, thank you, Chandradasa. The wonders of modern technology, despite all the wonders of modern technology like this present meeting, painting still exists as a potential viable media for communicating meaning.
Mm.
Yeah, come and see some more.
Yeah, long may it be so, perhaps more so than ever. And thanks to you too, Amita Jyoti, for taking us on a walk through the woods of your mind. A lovely way to hear about your practice of painting.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. It's lovely to be here with you all. Thanks.
Thank you to you too, Parma Bodhi, for coming again to the podcast and letting us hear some of your tall and short tales of life at the sharp end of obituary painting, which I think might be unique in the history of art. You might be the first person to... It is not. Oh, no, I was really hoping you'd be the first person to consistently paint obituaries.
There's Adam McEwen and a guy called Barshard who died fairly recently. I've got a book just called Obituaries of his work. He made obituary sculptures out of the front pages of the New York Times when they put their obituaries on the front page of the New York Times when they're very significant people.
Ah.
But anyway, look, it's been a pleasure. I think it's been very helpful for the three of us. I think so anyway. And always a pleasure, Chandradasa. I hope I'll see you soon over your way.
You absolutely will. It's a real pleasure for me and for also for our audience just to hear, I suppose, three resplendent Buddhists. Sometimes you hear the word Buddhist and you think, what is that about? But this is what it's about. It's like you three and your lives and your work. And it comes across very well. So I'm excited about your exhibition. I'm definitely going to try and get there by hook or by crook if I possibly can. It'd be very nice to see each of you again in real life. But for now, thank you for coming and speaking to us today. And thanks to you for listening out there. Again, if you enjoyed this conversation, if you liked it, tell a friend. You can even do the old-fashioned thing and go into Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever and leave a review so that people get to hear, oh, this one might be worth listening to out of the many millions of podcasts that arrive every week over the airwaves of the internet. We'll be back soon, I hope, with another episode. And in the meantime, please take care. Please look after yourself, look after other people. And we'll be met together again soon for another episode of Buddhist Center Podcast. Bye for now.